That's what you get really ready. Mr. Mark?
If it pleases the court, my name is Ken Martin. I represent Alaron International. If I may reserve 5 minutes. The issue presented in this case is whether or not the district court drew improper inferences in reaching its determination to sustain a motion to dismiss. The case involves an arbitration provision that was in a contract that was never signed between the parties. And
can we on that point? You didn't make that point below at all, right?
Your Honor, the point that was made below was that there was an abandonment of the subcontract.
Right, but just tendered. Focus on this one point, which you've made emphatically here, and which actually might have made a difference if made below. But you didn't argue in resisting the district court's decision, or in resisting the motion, I guess, for summary judgment, that the first contract wasn't even signed. Did you?
No, we never said that. We never raised in our pleadings the fact that it wasn't signed. Right. What we did raise was the fact that the subcontract that had been tendered had been abandoned.
Right. So you can continue to make that argument, but generally we won't hear an argument that you didn't give the district court a chance to rule on.
Well,
this is one that you didn't.
Your Honor, it's our view that there has to be a factual basis for the court to determine that there was an agreement to arbitrate.
Well, there was a contract in front of the judge. Your papers below certainly indicate that you thought that first contract was an effective contract, at least at some point. When you say it's abandoned, that means you had something which was then abandoned. But the wording of your papers below certainly gave the judge no hint that this just wasn't one of many copies of the contract that had been signed.
Well, Your Honor, our view is that, and I think the facts were clear, was that there was a subcontract that was tendered, but 10 days later, the status of forces agreement came into play that basically rendered that performance that was referenced in that subcontract irrelevant. There was a meeting of the minds and an agreement that the parties would subcontract and go forth and perform the contract together with a 51-49 split of contract revenue. However, that purpose was defeated.
You're representing that the fact that it was unsigned matters.
Well, I'm saying the fact that it was unsigned matters in the context of the arbitration clause and the agreement inside that subcontract that's asserted as establishing.
If there had been no second agreement, and if the status of forces agreement had not rendered this ineffective, and we were here, would you be relying in any way on the fact that the first document was unsigned?
No, I think that had the status of forces agreements not come into effect, and had the parties not had to change the nature of their...
Forget about whether, assuming that we came to court immediately after and there had been no performance or anything. Okay. Would you argue that because a document wasn't unsigned, there wasn't a valid first contract?
No, Your Honor, I would not be arguing that, because what I'd be arguing, the dispute in that case clearly would have arisen under the subcontract.
So you're not attaching any importance to the lack of the signature?
Well, what the importance I'm attaching, Your Honor, is the fact that there has to be some evidentiary basis for the court's finding that there was an agreement to arbitrate. We're not disputing the existence of a subcontract.
You agree that there was an agreement to arbitrate at the beginning?
At the beginning, yes.
Okay.
All right.
But let me just ask one more. Are you representing to the court that there is no signed version of that contract? I know there's none in the record. Are you representing that there is no such?
I have never seen a signed version of the subcontract. And in the context of the facts that occurred in this case, within 10 days of that contract being tendered, the whole nature of the performance changed, because under the subcontract, Alaron was to perform 49% of the work with its own employees and was to receive 49% of the total gross revenue that was generated under the prime contract. Once the status of forces agreement came into play, that purpose was defeated. There was no longer any performance by Alleron that was contemplated. From that point forward, the parties then undertook to preserve the bargain. Now, if you look at the language that has been asserted is, well, that means intent. Well, the intent of the subcontract was exactly as I've stated, was for Alleron to perform as a subcontractor. That intent was totally defeated now, but the bargain that the parties reached was the financial bargain. That's the meaning. In other words, how much would Alleron have realized under the subcontract had they been permitted to perform? And when the support agreement was structured, what the parties were in essence attempting to do was to establish a price whereby Alleron would then sell its employees to Cherokee nations.
Your evidence of these intention issues are the affidavits?
Well, we have the affidavit of Ron Groh.
Right, that's the evidence of it.
And again, what I'm referring to is this, is that the language in terms of establishing the bargain is it that expressly appears, but the word intent doesn't. So therefore, the court had to draw an inference to basically suggest that the intent was anything other than what I've just stated, because there was no evidence produced by CNI that would have expressed a contrary intent, or it was refuted by Ron Groh if we look at the competing affidavits between I agree with that, but if you look at paragraph one of that agreement, after you get beyond the whereas paragraphs, the first paragraph where it shows exactly what they agreed to, the parties state that the arrangement is entered into to preserve the bargain between the parties reached, and then it goes on to say
in the subcontract.
But then it goes on to say, between Alleron and CNI, and it cites a subcontract number, but it says, which the parties could not implement. So in effect, the parties agreed that the subcontract could no longer be implemented.
But it says to preserve the bargain in that document. Right?
That's my point, Your Honor. The bargain.
The evidence of what the bargain is, in your view, comes from the affidavit, right?
Well, the evidence of what the bargain is, I think, comes from the subcontract document itself in terms of the prices mm-hmm. that were in there. There was an appendix that established prices for the performance. Mm-hmm. That's basically the only evidence as to what the financial arrangement was between the parties.
So then you think we can look just at we don't need to look at the affidavit?
No,
so the rule in Oklahoma, like the rule in almost every other state, is if the documents are unambiguous, courts don't look at extrinsic evidence of subjective intent. So is your view that the documents are ambiguous and we must look at the affidavits, or is your view that the documents are unambiguous and they have the meaning that you say they have? Which is your view?
Well, my view is that when you refer to the bargain, you're referring to the financial arrangement between the parties.
And is that apparent on the face of the documents?
Well, obviously different people could differ on that point, but.
Well, do you regard the documents as unambiguous or not? What the position of the.
I would argue that the document is ambiguous on that
point.
Is ambiguous on that point. Mm-hmm. And I would argue that there was no evidence to support the district court's finding that one, these agreements constitute the same subject matter. Under the under the subcontract, the subject matter was Alleron's performance of 49% of the work using its own employees. That subject matter was totally defeated. In the appellee's briefs and in the court's decision, the subject matter is discussed with reference to the obligation.
That was the subcontract's purpose, was 49%? Is that
under the subcontract, what was going to happen under the subcontract is
49% of the contract revenue.
49% of the contract revenue would go to Alleron, and Alleron would provide 49% of the performance with its own employees.
And the difference here is?
The difference here is that Alleron no longer could provide employees under a subcontract and could no longer provide any performance.
But it gets 49% of all contract revenues.
No, it only gets 49% of the net revenue now, because Alleron, under the support agreement, was actually selling its employees to the Cherokees. Cherokee Nation took over performance responsibility of 100% of the prime contract, and what Alleron was to receive as its price for that, in essence, that sale of its employees, was the net value of those employees.
Just look at the second paragraph of the therefore on page 12.
Just consideration of entering this agreement?
Yeah. An amount, CNI agrees to pay Alleron an amount representing 49% of all contract revenue it receives.
However, it goes on to say less actual direct labor, housing, fringe benefit costs, which are the costs associated with the employees. Mm-hmm. And that gives you a net number, whereas all the revenue for those employees would have gone to Alleron before. In this case, they're getting the net revenue. But more importantly, if you look at the subcontract, which starts at page 17 of the administrative record, there are a myriad of clauses and performance obligations that no longer come into play under the administrative support agreement, because Alleron's no longer directly involved in Germany performing work. And that's what we assert is the subject matter of the subcontract, which was that Alleron was going to perform work. But when you go to the support agreement, in effect, what they've done is sold their employees, and they had no ongoing.
Even though the support agreement says its purpose is to preserve the benefits and obligations undertaken in the subcontract.
Well, I understand that it says the benefits and obligations, but
sounds
again,
like
what
a reference,
that?
It sounds like a reference between the two documents, an intention that the two documents be read as one, doesn't it? Except as modified by the second one.
Yeah, where they can be.
Yeah, except as modified by the second one.
Well, it gets back to the question of, well, where, one, I think that there is an absolute ambiguity as to what those benefits and obligations mean.
Well, there's no ambiguity, and if you've just pointed out one as to which there isn't an ambiguity. So the question is, why is there any ambiguity about the application of the arbitration clause? What's ambiguous about that?
Well, because, like I said, there was no agreement. There was no signed document.
Well, I thought we've agreed that the fact that it wasn't signed is irrelevant.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not agreeing that it's irrelevant that it's not signed, because
you agreed there was a meeting of the minds about the arbitration clause, right?
There was a meeting of the minds about the entire subcontract agreement at the time that the parties believed that there was going to be performance in Germany. However, as Ron Groh states in his affidavit, that when that purpose was defeated, and when there was, in essence, a change from performance to a sale and transfer of Alleron's employees, he no longer had the intent to agree to arbitration.
I'm asking you, assuming that we can't look at the Groh affidavit because it's extrinsic evidence of intent, what language here, or put it another way, what language here is ambiguous with respect to arbitration that would lead us to look to Groh's affidavit?
When you say here, you're referring to the administrative support agreement?
Yeah.
There's no language in there that deals with an agreement to arbitrate.
Right. Unlike the other things in which it's different with the subcontract, where you actually pointed me to language.
If you take a look at paragraph 13 of that clause on page 14 of the appendix, it says that this This agreement shall be construed in accordance with the law of the state of Oklahoma.
Right.
There's an express waiver of sovereign immunity.
How is that inconsistent with arbitration?
Well, there is no reference to arbitration, whereas there was in the prior agreement. And this is a clause, this is a clause where the parties are basically reflecting or anticipating, that if there is a dispute, how it will be construed, but nowhere do they say that they're agreeing to arbitration. And Mr. Groh is saying that he never did agree to arbitration. And I would assert that the burden of proof in terms of the agreement to arbitrate is on the plaintiff. And in light of the fact that the subcontract is not signed, there has to be an affirmative basis for a conclusion that there was an agreement to subcontract that carried forward through the two documents. Now, the one case that's cited for the proposition that the two agreements should be read together is the Bixler case, the Oklahoma case. The court stated in that case that the agreements at issue in that case, which were lease agreements, I believe it was for oil well production, actually contained different terms, or conflicting terms. Well, there's conflicting terms in this agreement too, in the sense that there is no performance, there is no subcontract, there is no ongoing effort by Aileron, and Aileron has no obligations that flowed from the government through the prime contract that it has to perform. Therefore, the subject matter of the subcontract was totally destroyed. During the motion to dismiss proceedings, the parties actually, or Aileron argued, that there was abandonment of the subcontract on that basis. That should have created a fact question, particularly in the light of the fact that there's no indication that as to performance that Aileron was going to have any continuing role in relation to what was happening with the government. The status of forces agreement totally defeated why the parties entered into the subcontract. And that would be the basis of why Aileron asserts that there was no agreement to arbitrate. And as to the support agreement, Mr. Groh testified. And apparently the court overlooked it or chose not to consider it, but he put in an affidavit saying that he expressly bargained for the exclusion of an arbitration provision. And if you look at Mr. McFarland's affidavit, it was never opposed on that point. There was nothing confronting that point or that would suggest that wasn't true. And that was information that the court should have considered, which should have, in and of itself, precluded the decision. Because if these are two separate agreements, as we assert, and if they involve two separate types of subject matter, which we believe they do, then we're not talking about extrinsic evidence as relates to the subcontract clause. What we're talking about was what was the deal that was entered under the support agreement. And Mr. Groh says, consistent with the agreement, that he expressly bargained for the exclusion of that provision.
Okay, you're out of time.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Jim Prozek. I'm here to argue on behalf of Cherokee Nation Industries. I'd first like to address the issue of Mr. Groh's affidavit and whether it was proper for the court to consider that affidavit. Nowhere below did Aileron ever argue that either the subcontract or the support agreement were ambiguous. The interpretation and construction of a clear and unambiguous contract is a matter of law for the court, which under Oklahoma law must be determined from the four corners of the document itself. As far as counsel's statement that the support agreement does appear ambiguous when he was arguing before the court today, I would simply direct the court to page 11 of the reply brief that Aileron filed here in this court, in which, however, as CNI states, Aileron does not argue that the support agreement is ambiguous. So Aileron has affirmatively stated to this court.
Did you say that? Where is that?
That appears on page 11 of the reply brief that Aileron filed in this court under subheading 4.
What was the, was there testimony by Groh?
Mr. Groh submitted an affidavit. There was no testimony.
The opposing counsel just mentioned something about testimony. That was just the affidavit, same thing? Okay. So did the district court reject the affidavit?
The district court did not say one way or the other whether it specifically rejected Mr. Groh's affidavit. CNI did argue in the briefs below that it could not consider Mr. Groh's affidavit because it was extrinsic evidence and the contracts were unambiguous.
And what did they argue? What did they respond to that? Did they respond to your argument below?
There was never an argument made below that the contract was ambiguous. It was simply that this is what Mr. Groh said.
I see. Okay.
And as I say again, in the reply brief, it's under section Roman numeral 4, the reply brief in subheading A at page 11. He makes the statement, CNI asserts that under Oklahoma law, an ambiguous contract is a question of law, and he cites our brief at page 12. What we actually said was an unambiguous contract is a question of law for the court.
If he's right on the abandonment of the subcontract, the support agreement by itself is not sufficient to enforce any arbitration.
The support agreement, you're right, Your Honor. The support agreement does not have an arbitration provision in it. However, Oklahoma law makes clear where two contracts, although not executed at the same time, refer to the same subject matter and show on their face that one is entered into to effectuate the other, they will be construed together as one contract. And the Bixler case, as counsel correctly points out, the court did find that there were conflicting provisions. One contract required that there be two wells drilled. The other required that only one well be drilled. So the court found there was a conflict and said because of that, one agreement was not on its face shown that it was enacted to effectuate the other. What I would direct the court's attention to is the Davis case from the Oklahoma Supreme Court that we cited in our brief, Davis versus Hastings. And that case, the Oklahoma Supreme Court addressed the sale of a business. There was a contract entered on June 27th for the sale of a business that had two provisions in it. One was an acknowledgement that there had been a payment made, and the second was that the party that was selling the business would remain with the business for a period of time in order to help with the transition. 2 days later, there was a second agreement signed. The second agreement did not contain either the acknowledgement of the payment or the requirement that the seller stay with the business for a period. Of course, when the seller decided he was not going to stay with the business and was just going to leave, the buyer of the business sought rescission of the contract. On appeal, or in the trial court, and both on appeal, the defendant had argued that the second contract controlled, that it was intended to be a complete integration, and the court said no. There is no conflict between the two provisions that are in the first contract and are not in the second contract. Both contracts were executed they were not executed at the same time, but one clearly shows on his face it was effectuated, the purpose was to effectuate the other contract, and that's exactly what we have here. The transfer and support agreement, which was drafted by Aileron, repeatedly states that its purpose is to preserve the benefit of the bargain reached in the subcontract. So the judge and the district court was absolutely correct in concluding that both the support agreement and the subcontract had to be read together. There is no conflict between the two. As far as the argument that...
Well, there is. I thought there was as far as the 4951.
No, Your Honor, there is not.
But a difference.
No. Under either situation, Aileron was to be paid 49% of the net. The difference was under the subcontract, Aileron deducted certain of the expenses. In the second, the expenses were deducted, and then the 49% went to Aileron. In either case, under the subcontract or the formula under the support agreement, the bottom line result was that Aileron was to receive 49% of the net revenue that CNI received from the government under the contract. So the formula may have been a little bit different, but the net result was the same. 49% of the revenue, the net revenue, went to Aileron at the end. As far as that distinction, I think that's a distinction without a difference in this case. The issue is, was the support agreement entered into to effectuate the purpose of the subcontract? Well, regardless of whether the purpose of the subcontract was simply to see that Aileron got 49%, or it was, as the district court found, the means by which the parties would work together to satisfy CNI's arguments to the government, the support agreement was still entered into to effectuate the purpose of the subcontract. Now, I think the court was absolutely proper in looking at the language and concluding that the purpose of the subcontract and the support agreement both were to allow CNI to access Aileron's employees, whether it be as a subcontractor or whether it be as an assignment of the employees, to use those employees to fulfill CNI's obligations under the government. But even if you accept Aileron's position that the only purpose was the 49%, the transfer agreement was still entered into to preserve the benefit of the subcontract, that Aileron get paid 49%. As far as the argument that it was only the 49%, again, the transfer and support agreement, which Aileron itself drafted, doesn't say that the purpose is just the 49%. In the page 12 of the appendix, the support agreement, the third whereas paragraph says, whereas CNI subcontracted with Aileron to access Aileron's experienced pool of employees and Aileron's unique capabilities as the incumbent contractor on the predecessor contract. So the point is, they're accessing Aileron's employees to perform. Whether they access those employees where Aileron is a subcontractor or whether they access those employees by a transfer of the employees, the bottom line result is the same. Either under the subcontract or the support agreement, Aileron had no direct responsibility to the government. CNI was the party responsible to the government. In one instance, the subcontract allowed allowed CNI to access Aileron's employees to perform the contract. In the other, it allowed them to access Aileron's employees to perform the contract. The result is exactly the same.
What do you say about his argument? I guess it's his argument that the choice of law provision in the support agreement, that is, this will be determined according to Oklahoma law, impliedly, I guess, means the arbitration clause from the subcontract was another, was an alteration in the subcontract.
Well, Your Honor, I think, first of all, there is the same clause in each contract. Each contract provides that it's to be governed by Oklahoma law, both the subcontract and the support agreement. And I think the situation that Your Honor just posed is directly within the facts of the Davis case that I just discussed, where there were two key provisions that were in the first agreement, the acknowledgement of the $600 payment and the agreement to stay on for a period of time. And the court found that even though those two provisions were not in the second agreement that was executed later, they were still a part of the contract because they were an essential part of the contract. That's exactly the point where the situation that we have here. You have the arbitration provision in the subcontract. It's not in the support agreement. It does not appear in the support agreement, but it is an essential provision, and as the court correctly found that.
Why is it the essential provision that Oklahoma law governs?
Excuse me?
Why is it the essential provision, the provision that's common to both, that Oklahoma law governs? Why is that?
That provision was carried through. Your Honor, Aileron drafted the contract. I think you'd have to ask Aileron.
But what I'm saying is, how do we know the arbitration clause was essential or vital if it's not in the support agreement, and yet the provision of choice of law is in both, indicating that it is essential?
Well, Your Honor, the second contract was enacted to effectuate the first. They have to be read together, and therefore the fact that it's not in the second contract, I think, is irrelevant because both documents have to be read together, as the court correctly found.
I guess that the Oklahoma rule about reading two contracts together would be moot or irrelevant if it meant that all the provisions of the first have to be in the second. Then you wouldn't need a rule like that. Then you'd just have a rule that says we're going to read the second. The provision about Oklahoma law governing, though, in the first is specifically about the arbitration clause, right?
It appears in two different places, Your Honor. It appears in that clause, uh-huh. And it also appears in,
where's the other place?
Forgive me if I have to look through it, but it is in two different places. I've cited them in the brief, and I don't recall off the top of my head. It appears in paragraph 28, which is the arbitration and forum choice,
uh-huh.
And then it appears again. I'd have to look, Your Honor. I have to page through it. I know it appears a second time, and I can find it in my brief.
You mean more generally about, rather than just about arbitration?
It is in a second provision in the subcontract agreement outside of the. Is the arbitration provision, and it does apply in that provision, Your Honor. I apologize for not being.
All right, maybe while your opponent is speaking, you can see if you can find it. And
all right. Yes,
us.
I can.
Great.
If I might briefly address the issue of the signature, had it not been waived below, there are numerous cases, although I couldn't find one from this court, that say that the Federal Arbitration Act requires that the arbitration provision be in writing. It does not require that that writing be signed. And the Tenth Circuit, the Seventh Circuit most recently said that in the case of Tinder versus Pinkerton Security, which is at 305 F3rd 728. The Eighth Circuit made that finding in the case of Berkeley versus Dillard's, which is at 450 F3rd 775, a 2006 decision from that court. The Tenth Circuit said it in the case of Medical Development Corporation versus Industry Molding, 479 F. Second 345. So there are numerous courts that have held that the fact that the agreement is not signed is not going to prevent it from being effective. Your Honor, the contracts before the district court were clear and unambiguous. Under the clear and unambiguous language of those contracts, the court determined the intent. The court found that the support agreement was entered into to effectuate the purpose of the subcontract. The court did not specifically reject Mr. Groh's testimony. However, it would have been improper for the court to have considered Mr. Groh's testimony, particularly in light of the admission in the brief in this court that the contract is not ambiguous. The district court was absolutely correct after drawing all inferences in favor of Aileron that.
I just pause over 1 second. Just want to be sure I understand. What they agreed was that the subcontract was unambiguous. They don't agree that the two of them together are unambiguous, do they?
They said that the support agreement is unambiguous in their brief.
Yes, and when did they agree that the subcontract is unambiguous?
They've never said that it was not. We made the argument in our briefs, Your Honor, that both were plain and unambiguous. Aileron at no point ever disputed that point, and in fact, at page 11 of their reply brief here, have said that the support agreement is unambiguous. We simply ask that the court affirm the district court. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Why don't you take 1 minute, Mr. Martin, and Mr. Prozic, if you could find that other provision.
May it please the court, our view is that when you merge the two together, that's when the ambiguity starts, because Ron Groh testified that it was his intent when he negotiated this that there not be an arbitration clause, so he did not intend with the support agreement to bring the other agreement forward. The other point that was raised was that the second agreement was enacted to affect the first. There's no evidence of that. The second agreement was enacted because the SOFA agreement destroyed
the purpose of the first agreement. Also, council talked about the fact that there was no direct responsibility to the government. In relation to the last point, this is a significant point. Aileron's objective was not to worry about CNI's obligations to the government. Its objective was to perform as a subcontractor under the first agreement, and under the second agreement, its objective was to get paid for transferring its employees. These are two wholly different purposes. Council said that we were not supposed to get, we would not get paid 49% of the contract under the subcontract. We would not get 49% of the revenue under the subcontract. That is simply not the case. What council is doing is merging the two as if they're one. Aileron was absolutely going to get paid 49% of the revenue, and with that, it would obviously pay the cost of performance, which would include Aileron paying its employees. But under the second agreement, it had no employees. It had no performance obligations. Therefore, the deal there was that it would have the net. In terms of an intent to have the two documents come together, the support agreement and the subcontract, there's a merger clause in the subcontract that says it constitutes the entire agreement between the parties. And coupling that with Mr. Groh's his affidavit, he states that there was no intent to bring that forward. So when you talk about the subject matter, from Aileron's perspective, the subject matter was not to support CNI, particularly under the second agreement. The subject matter of the agreement in the first instance was its performance as a subcontractor, and under the second agreement, preserving an economic benefit by basically selling its employees, and then it would have no performance obligation left. Now, this status of forces agreement totally destroyed the purpose of the first agreement. So, thank you. Appreciate it.
Yes, Your Honor, I do. It appears again in paragraph 18 of the subcontract, which is page 6 of the subcontract and page 22.